This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Political Review. Last week, I mentioned that we're pivoting the show away from direct intervention in party politics, although party politics will continue to be a feature of the show. And last week, as I mentioned, I wanted to get started sort of looking at some of the geopolitical realities that are impinging on how we do governance in the Bahamas. And this week, we're going to talk a little bit about the recent World Bank International Monetary Fund spring meetings. I'm also going to dive into what happened in the American banking system and have a look at what sort of fallout that crisis might have for us in the region and us specifically here in the Bahamas. And of course, you're welcome to join me. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. You can call at 323-6232, 325-4316, or 325-4259. Of course, you're also welcome to send us your text messages at 422-4796. That's 422-4796. Before I start the session about the spring meetings held in Washington, I want to point out that the Securities Commission of the Bahamas has recently circulated amendments to the DARE Act for public feedback. You can go to the SCB website and download the proposed amendments and have a peek at them and see what your thoughts are. And I know that Crypto Isle is preparing to do a survey, which I believe is supposed to drop tomorrow, to get feedback from interested parties on the proposed amendments. And so I would encourage you to participate in that survey as a matter of national importance. So go check out the proposed amendments to the DARE Act and make your opinion known, because this is incredibly important legislation. The world economy is wrestling with how to assimilate digital assets, and the forward-looking and forward-leaning people and companies and organizations in our global economy and in the more advanced countries are already wrestling with the inclusion of cryptocurrencies in some kind of banking and domestic investment infrastructure. And we have this legislation that is among the best legislation in the world. I mean, incredibly benchmarked against legislation from all over the world. And our regulatory regime is, you know, despite what happened with SBF, our regulatory regime is among the best in the world, if not the best in the world. And so you, as a member of this community, as a citizen of this country, as a potential domestic investor in the digital asset space, you need to become very, very familiar with what the government is proposing. And if you have other ideas or you have recommendations, you need to share them. So that's my public service announcement for the day. And now let's dive in to the political review for this week. Our look at the spring meetings of the World Bank Group and International Monetary Fund, which were held in D.C. recently. World leaders and finance ministers, central bankers from across the world, economists, media all converged on Washington, D.C. to address the economic outlook for the rest of 2023 and to look at projections for 2024. Now, the meetings concluded 2 weeks ago, but they left least developed countries and small island states feeling dissatisfied, honestly speaking. You know, fears of a global recession hung over the meetings due to widespread monetary policy tightening, due to deteriorating financial conditions and the attendant decline in confidence. Issues such as runaway inflation, instability in the banking sector, and the threat of a trade due to growing tensions between the U.S. and China dominated many of the discussions at those meetings. The need for new funding mechanisms to help developing countries adapt to the green transition, the fallout from COVID, and the risk of a serious debt crisis was a recurrent theme of the meetings. Developing countries like those here in the Caribbean region called for radical changes in how the multilateral development banks, which includes the World Bank, provide development funding. Last July, the G20 published an independent report which found that multilateral development banks, including the World Bank, were overly cautious in their approach to lending and could unlock hundreds of billions of dollars in new loans for lower income nations without endangering their stability and without endangering. However, efforts to raise new funding have been slow, and few substantive commitments were made at these meetings. Now, last week I had talked about the IMF and the World Bank Group and the Caribbean Development Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank and these MDBs as potential sources for funding at concessionary rates for the Bahamas in particular, of course, and the fact that their lending regimes have undergone some transformation away from some of the more problematic interference in sovereignty concerns that had been a part of their reputation in the past. Well, this week, the other side of the coin is what we're looking at, which is they are slow to make changes and make reforms that will benefit lesser developed countries and small island developing states in a tangible way. And they're moving incredibly slowly in terms of making those reforms. It was agreed that the World Bank's International Bank for Reconstruction and Development would lower its equity to loan ratio from 20% to 19% in a relaxation of lending restrictions that would unlock an additional $4 billion in loans to middle-income countries that are not eligible for concessional finance. Now, that's relevant because the Bahamas is, despite being a small island developing state, considered a middle-income country and national finance. This is something that I don't know if you remember, but Perry Christie, when he was prime minister, made a significant amount of noise on the international stage about how unfair it is to classify countries like the Bahamas with relatively high income based purely on GDP when the other markers of economic development aren't there. But it is to be said that the IBRD is lowering its equity to loan ratio by a percentage point, which unlocks an additional $4 billion in loans to countries like the Bahamas, which are classified as middle income and not eligible for concessional finance. I am, given the need for financing and new money that our government has expressed, I imagine that this will be good news, and that we will hear from the Ministry of Finance something about the Bahamas and the IBRD striking a deal sometime in short order. But while the IBRD lends to the governments of middle-income and credit-worthy low-income countries, many LDCs, that's less developed countries, and SIDS, or SIDS, that's us, small island developing states, remain reliant on the bank's other lending arm, the International Development Association. Now, the IDA lends to the poorest countries on more favorable terms than the borrower could obtain in the marketplace, and has been issuing loans to governments at faster rates in recent years to deal with debt, food security, and COVID-19. However, shareholders have not yet agreed to replenish the IDA, and massive demand looms for bank loan refinancing by borrowers in 2024. It's a huge deal. Martin Kessler is the director of the Paris-based think tank Finance for Development Lab, and he said there's a realization that there will be a drop in IDA financing in 2024, and that something needs to be done about it, particularly for the countries that are depending on that financing. Kessler said that maybe a decision about the IDA could be taken at the summit for a new global finance pact in Paris in June, or at the annual meetings of the World Bank IMF in October. So in my research this week, I came across, share with you the African perspective on these meetings, because I think it's good to hear the different perspectives from around the globe. And I think that you will hear some very strong synergies between how Africa saw the meetings and our own views here in the Bahamas. So at a meeting of the African High-Level Working Group on the Global Financial Architecture, during these spring meetings, the members of that group, including African ministers of finance, planning, and economic development, as well as African and global multilateral institutions, including the World Bank and IMF staff and executive directors, all expressed deep concern over what they said was the shortfall in resources for the IMF's Poverty Reduction and Growth Trust. That trust provides concessional lending to low-income countries. The group called for the IMF to sell part of its gold reserves in the medium term to increase the availability of funding. And the group also urged the IMF to raise the annual access limits of the Rapid Credit Facility and the Rapid Financing Instrument. These are emergency lending facilities that have been crucial in the response to COVID-19, and the Bahamas has taken advantage of both of those instruments in very recent times. The African ministers and executives argued that the global interest rate hikes have made longer-term financing under the IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Trust expensive, necessitating a freeing of interest rates at the trust and a boost in its resources. The ministers stressed the need for loans at low interest rates with long maturities in the face of countries' long-term investment needs for achieving the UN Sustainable Development Goals and for combating climate change. They also reiterated long-standing demands to scrap IMF surcharges, which include additional interest payments due on loans, and to allow Africa a greater allocation of IMF special drawing rights. While the IMF funding reform may be a ways off, U.S. President Joe Biden's nomination of Ajay Banga to replace David Malpass, who will step down as the president of the World Bank at the end of June, has raised hopes that the Indian-born business executive forms to rejig the IMF's lending model. As we have listened to the concerns and assertions of the African nations, I think you would agree that they echo statements that have been made by Bahamian and other Caribbean community officials over the years. It is becoming a trend, and not a positive one in my view, that these voices continue to speak in what appears to be a vacuum, as no significant progress is made year over year. Apologies, folks. Somebody didn't realize I was on the air. yeah. In fact, despite some progress on the issue of crippling debt, African ministers left with feelings of disappointment and asking a crucial question. And this is the question that is the other side of the coin from my comments last week. Are the IMF and World Bank, which were founded nearly 80 years ago, ready to evolve in order to ensure the global macroeconomic stability they were set up to create? So, to close out our brief review of the meetings at the IMF World Bank in DC 2 weeks ago, it's more of the same. The talk is big. The statements are effusive. Everyone is great at diagnosing the problem. Everyone is amazing at prescribing the solutions that clearly would work. But when the rubber meets the road, nothing gets done. And if not nothing, then too late. And in a country like the Bahamas, where we have one foot in both worlds, we are a small island developing state, but we are also a middle income country. We need to figure out how we are going to address the world economic architecture in a way that makes sense for us. And I am not yet convinced that over the last 50 years, we have done the best we could. We've done well, don't get me wrong. I'm not naive. We have certainly done well. But I think that we would all agree that our domestic economic concerns are anachronistic. We in 2023 should not be worried about what our children are going to do for a living in this country. Parents, Bahamian parents, should not have to wrestle with themselves in 2023 about an inclination they have to tell their college student children to stay where they are and not come home. People who are done with college, Bahamians who are done with college, should not have in 2023 the existential dread of what would I do if I go home? How will I make a living? I may have said some of this before a while ago, but I think it's relevant to reiterate. I know some folks who have come home from college and from working abroad. And I'm thinking one set of people, five people I know who fit this category. These are people whose income, wherever they may have been in the world, was more than $500,000 a year. And they came home because they wanted to, quote unquote, build their country, or because their family is here and they wanted to be close to family, or for whatever reasons they may have come home. And in some cases, they could not find work to even give a salary or income of half of what they were making outside the country. You know, in some cases, it was less than a quarter of what they were making outside the country. And they were willing to take that loss because they love the Bahamas, they love their family, this is where they want to be. But they shouldn't have to. And that's only a couple of people in my circle at that, you know, incredibly high level of income. If you take it lower, you know, people who are making 100 grand or more a year, you know, those people, when they come home, if they appear to be lucky to get 50 grand, 60 grand a year. And the people who are here making six figures, and there are a number of them, horizons are perhaps even more limited. You know, which is maybe one reason why the market at that level seems so competitive and so vicious, because once you cross that six-figure barrier, you know, you're more or less stuck at whatever level you cross it. So our economy is not built to encourage our citizens that there is an endless upward trajectory to their economic environment. And I believe that if we were to make use of the multilateral agencies in a more sustained and programmatic way, if we were to strategize a little better, we might be able to do something about that. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's just my view. Meanwhile, let's introduce the subject of the banking crisis, the international banking crisis. This is an issue that we imagine will continue to have some long-term fallout, but about which most of us have only a little knowledge or understanding. We aim to have policy and legislative approaches that could be taken by our governments to address the fallout. And just so you remember what happened, you know, panic spread across the world, in particular the startup world, as business startups, as worries about the financial health of Silicon Valley Bank, a major lender to fledgling U.S. companies, prompted the Peter Thiel's Founders Fund and other prominent venture capitalists to advise portfolio businesses to withdraw their money, even as the bank's top executives urged calm. And that was the touchstone. So for context, what happened? On March 10th, the biggest failure of the U.S. bank since the global financial crisis in 2008 played out in real time as a lender to the tech industry succumbed to a classic bank run. Silicon Valley Bank, as we discussed, had customers who were frantically pulling their money from the California-based lender before U.S. regulators intervened to take control. But the collapse of the bank panicked U.S. markets, piling pain onto weaker financial institutions already struggling with the unintended consequences of soaring interest rates and self-inflicted wounds. So on Friday, March 10th, the U.S. government's Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or the FDIC, took control of SVB. It was the biggest banking collapse in America since Washington Mutual in 2008. The wheels started to come off 2 days earlier when the bank took a multi-billion dollar loss cashing out U.S. government bonds to raise money to pay depositors. It tried, unsuccessfully, to sell shares to shore up its finances. That triggered the panic that led to its downfall. Then a second U.S. regional bank, Signature Bank, was shut down. And then a third, First Republic Bank, was propped up in short order, and the first to a bank of global financial significance, that bank would be Credit Suisse, was averted only after it was taken over by UBS. We'll come back to that in a bit. On Sunday, March 12th, at the FDIC, that's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, shut down Signature Bank after a run on its deposits by customers who were spooked by the implosion of SVB. Both banks had an unusually high ratio of uninsured deposits to fund their businesses. Relative calm Relative calm was restored only thanks to the provision of huge sums of money, emergency cash from lenders of last resort, so that would be the central banks, and some of the industry's strongest players. Markets remain on edge. Benchmark indexes of shares in U.S. and European banks lost 20% and 13% respectively due to the fallout. On Wednesday, March 15th, after watching shares in Credit Suisse collapse by as much as 30%, Swiss authorities announced a backstop for the country's second biggest bank. It calmed the immediate market panic, but the global player was not out of the woods. Investors and customers were worried that it didn't have a credible plan to reverse long-term decline in its business. Then on Thursday, March 16th, First Republic Bank was teetering on the brink as customers again withdrew their deposits. In a meeting in Washington, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Jamie Dimon, the CEO of America's largest bank, Chase, drew up plans for a private sector rescue. The result was an agreement with a group of American lenders to deposit tens of billions of dollars of cash into First Republic to staunch the bleeding. Then on Sunday, March 19th, Switzerland's biggest bank, UBS, agreed to buy its ailing rival, Credit Suisse, in an emergency rescue deal aimed at stemming financial market panic. As you are watching the dominoes fall, one after another, and they just kept getting bigger. And how much did the rescue cost? The count so far for the rescue of all these banks is more than $400 billion in direct support. Guaranteeing all deposits at Silicon Valley and Signature Bank, the U.S. Federal Reserve is on the hook for $140 billion. Then there's the $54 billion the Swiss National Bank offered Credit Suisse in the form of an emergency loan, and 209 billion Swiss francs, which is $225 billion, offered to USB in loans, guaranteed by the Swiss state, and protection against potential losses. The Fed has also of loans to other banks late in March. The banks borrowed nearly $153 billion from the Fed, smashing the previous record of $112 billion set during the crisis of 2008. Banks also drew on nearly $12 billion of loans from the Fed. I mean, this is, are you listening to the amounts of money here, right? $12 billion of loans from the Fed's new emergency lending program established at the start of the week with the aim of preventing more banks from collapsing. And while the $318 billion the Fed loaned in total to the financial system is about half of what was extended during the global financial crisis, JP Morgan's Michael Feroli said in an investor note that it's still a big number. And he said the glass half empty view was that the banks needed a lot of money. The glass half full take is intended. The banking industry also coughed up billions. JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup are among a group of 11 lenders providing $30 billion in cash infusion aimed at storing up confidence in First Republic. HSBC has reportedly committed more than $2 billion to SVB's UK business, which it bought on Sunday for £1. So what's the point? For U.S. actors, That's U.S. business people and U.S. consumers. Will all of this make it harder to get a loan? The short answer is yes. Stressed banks will pay much greater attention to the creditworthiness of borrowers, whether they're businesses looking for loans or home buyers trying to find mortgages. Treasury Secretary Yellen said in testimony to the Senate Finance Committee on Capitol Hill that if bankers are under stress, they might be reluctant to lend, which could lead to credit becoming more expensive and less available. Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, and I'm sure you remember that she was also the first woman president of the IMF, told reporters that persistently elevated market tensions could further constrict credit conditions that were already tightening in response to rising interest rates. So does this make a recession more likely? Again, Yellen also told the Senate committee the situation could turn this into a source of significant downside economic risk. Goldman Sachs said in March that growing stress in the banking sector has boosted the odds of a U.S. recession within the next 12 months. The bank now believes, that would be Goldman Sachs, now believes that the American economy has a 35% chance of entering a recession within a year, up from 25% before the banking sector meltdown started. And the world's second biggest economy, China, is also sputtering despite a burst of activity following the rapid ending of the draconian COVID lockdown measures late last year. In a surprise move, the Chinese central bank cut the amount of money the country's lenders are required to hold in reserve in a bid to keep cash flowing. That's the fallout on a micro level. If you pull back the lens a little bit, let's look at what the Federal Reserve's March policy meeting had to say about it. And the notes from that meeting were released about 2 weeks ago. And they say that the fallout from the recent banking crisis is likely to push the U.S. economy into a mild recession later this year. Since November of last year, staff economists at the Federal Reserve have predicted subdued growth in the United States and a weakening economy during policy decision meetings. Last month, they said the banking crisis heightened that forecast to a recession. Minutes from the Fed's most recent two-day monetary policy meeting, which was held on March 21st and 22nd, say that taking into account the potential economic effects of the recent banking sector developments, Fed economists' projection at the time of the March meeting included a mild recession starting later this year. So, and to be clear before I move on, this is the first time in the current hiking cycle that the Fed's staff economists have forecast such a recession. What is that? Well, we'll get to what that means in a bit. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the Consumer Price Index, that is the most closely watched inflation gauge, rose 5% in March from a year earlier. I'll read that again. The Consumer Price Index in the U.S., which is the most closely watched inflation gauge, rose 5% in March from 1 year earlier, according to data released early this month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. keep in mind that while Fed has confidence in the banking industry, the Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that they can make borrowing harder, which can also curb spending, and that would ease some pressure on prices and the labor market. So now the U.S. Fed has to balance taming the still high inflation with ensuring financial stability and factoring other economic shocks like the recent surprise decision from OPEC Plus to cut global oil production. Good God. Meanwhile, congressional lawmakers such as Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren called for investigations into the bank failures and legislating additional rules, such as raising FDIC insurance limits for deposits. At present, if I remember, those limits are $250,000 for people and for $500,000 for businesses. So if you have an account that is below, a personal account that's below $250,000, all of your money is insured. And if you have a business account below $500,000, all your money is insured as well. But what are we looking at? I mean, what's the real impact of this? In a recent interview, renowned investor Warren Buffett talked about his thoughts on whether a recession would indeed be occurring in the U.S. economy. Talked with Buffett on his recent trip to Japan. As the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett usually gets an unmatched look into the U.S. economy. Berkshire Hathaway is a holding company that owns more than 65 different companies in a variety of industries across the world. So in addition to the U.S. economy, he has insight into the global economy because he gets to see exactly how these companies are performing on a monthly, weekly, even a daily basis. This would allow Buffett to really give to have a deep understanding of what's happening in the economy at any given time. So I think it'd be interesting to hear Lolly, I think I would like to play these clips in a different order. Can you play the clip from Jamie Dimon first? And then you can play the Warren Buffett interview right after. And you can play those clips anytime. Sorry to spring that change on you, Wally. I apologize.
We have heard recently from Jamie Dimon and his aunt.
Yeah, stock markets. Where do you see the trough for the S&P 500?
It could be another easy 20%. The next 20% will be much more painful than the first. Rates going up another 100 basis points are a lot more painful than the first 100. You see a lack of liquidity in a lot of markets. And this is serious stuff, okay? This is inflation, rates going up more. It's QT, which we've never had before. And it's the war. And these are very, very serious things, which I think are likely to push the U.S. to some kind of recession 6 to 9 months from now.
Annual letter at J.P. Morgan, he says a recession is much more likely now. Janet Yellen was just speaking, I think in the last 24 hours, although it's hard to track from here when things are happening, has just said in the last 24 hours, I think, that the U.S. is in better shape now than it was 6 months ago. Which of those camps would you put yourself in?
Well, I know what a lot of different businesses are doing, and I just got report from one of them that happens to be in the retail-related business. And in any event, you know, it was minus 22% in February from a year ago.
And
they didn't think that was going to happen.
Sales? You mean
in sales.
Profit?
Yeah. In sales, profits are down a lot more than that. On the other hand, some of our businesses are still doing fine, but they all are reporting that the new, you know, some of them are living off of orders were placed months earlier and that sort of thing. But it's a tougher world out there in a great many businesses, not in the insurance business. Insurance business should be better this year than last year. That doesn't mean it will be, because we can't predict everything that happens, but on a probability basis, it should be better than last year. And the railroad business is down, and carloads carried, but it isn't dramatic. And of course, we've got a utility business, and that doesn't really vary much with things. So overall, I think people that run our businesses that do have any sensitivity to the economy are surprised at where they are now compared to where they thought they were going to be 6 months ago. That doesn't mean the world is coming to an end or anything, because 58 years I've been running Berkshire, I mean, we've run into all kinds of problems, but that's what business is about. And we run our business so that we don't depend on everything being big hunky-dory always. We run it so that we will be the last man standing. And that's the way, if millions of people are going to give me their money and tell me to take care of it, we're going to try and take care of it. And if we don't make as much money as we might have if we'd leveraged more or done other policies, so be it.
But you think a recession is more likely now than maybe you would have said 6 months ago?
Well, I think most of our managers would say that they are surprised at where they are now compared to how they thought they were going to feel 6 months ago at this point.
And not
in a lot of businesses, but not in the insurance business, you know. And I think the people at the railroad are somewhat surprised that car loadings aren't a little higher rather than a little lower, you know, somewhat lower. But most of the stuff we carry is essential, but it reflects what's happening. And of course, supply lines were so disrupted and everything a year or two ago that, no economic figures are pure, but I'm just telling you my impression. And I look at the numbers every day. I mean, I look at our Easter sales day by day at the candy store, and I can look at California versus Washington versus Oregon, and I get them the next day. I mean, I love figures, you know. You say that it doesn't really do me that good to be such a figure nut, but I just like them when I see them.
Okay, so it's...
So, if you listen carefully to what Buffett said, as positive as he is sounding there, he's also given a real answer to questions, right? When asked about his thoughts on the likelihood of a recession in the U.S., he pointed out that some of his managers are reporting a 22% drop in sales, with profits down a lot more. And when pressed, although gently pressed, he said that, you know, most of his managers are surprised at where they are now versus where they expected them. So even while staying positive, he's acknowledging that, you know, the recession talk is not nonsense and it's not unlikely or unrealistic. But what about the global fallout from this crisis? The International Monetary Fund is reporting that the continued fallout and credit tightening as a result of the banking crisis in the U.S., which did spill over, as we've already pointed out, to Switzerland through Credit Suisse and UBS, is dampening the outlook for the global economy that was already showing signs of cooling with high inflation and rising interest rates. So the fund is projecting total economic output to increase this year by 2.8%, which is a decline from the 3.4% output in 2022. So the IMF's, I mean, I hope you're paying attention. This is not a, anyway. The IMF's World Economic Outlook report said the risks to economic growth have grown significantly after the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in the U.S. and the forced acquisition of Credit Suisse, which have hurt confidence in the banking system. The report says that the tentative signs in early 2023 that the world economy could achieve a soft landing, that would be with inflation coming down and growth holding steady, have receded amid stubbornly high inflation and the recent financial sector turmoil. That is to say, those early positive indications, to be clear, have now weakened due to the fallout of this crisis. Advanced economies are expected to see the most pronounced slowdowns, going from 2.75% growth last year to a projection of only 1.3% positive growth in 2023. Emerging and developing economies, such as India and China, on the other hand, are expected to grow more than 5% this year. I wonder, what the pivot is going to be when it comes to the investment attraction tours undertaken by the investment boosters in our government and private sector. I hope they're paying attention to that. But the IMF is projecting the U.S. economy to grow at 1.6% this year, a drop from 2.1% in 2022, and consistent with some other economists' projections of what they are referring to as a slow session, where the economy cools enough to ease inflation without dipping into negative territory. Excuse me. That would likely result in slightly higher unemployment, which has remained low compared to historical averages, and achieve a soft landing with minimal economic pain. The soft landing, like we say, I don't know, we'll see. The IMF's report said that central banks should continue to fight inflation, which is still lingering around the world, and adding to the uncertainty, that's the lingering inflation. Inflation in the U.S. fell for the ninth consecutive month to 5% in March, with Wednesday's release of the Consumer Price Index. Fed's preferred target for inflation is 2% on an annual basis, which could lead, to another interest rate increase at the next Federal Open Market Committee meeting in May. But lingering inflation is another major risk for the global outlook, as central banks would be forced into more rate increases in a time of greater risk and volatility. On a slightly more positive note, despite the added risks brought on by the bank turmoil and high interest rates, the IMF did say that the current struggles are not like the 2008 financial crisis. So my initial impetus for getting into this story was to try and determine whether or not we in the Bahamas should be bracing ourselves for 2008-type financial environment. But the IMF points out that while the banking turmoil has raised financial stability risks, its roots are fundamentally different from those of the global financial crisis. Most banks were undercapitalized in 2008 compared to today's standards. They didn't hold as many liquid assets, and they took on excessive risks that spread beyond banking when things went wrong. So as much of a shock to the system as this recent crisis was, we should not be, let me rephrase, in danger of retreating to what it was like in 2008. And like I say, that was my major reason for getting into the story in the first place. So that concern can now, hopefully, knowing that all of the policy actions that have been taken are effective and that the line is held, and that way, you know, we'll just have to see how we muddle through a recession in the U.S. in the second half of the calendar year, you know, and see how it goes. So the question, I guess, is when you take all of this, particularly U.S.-based financial struggling, the question is always, given that the U.S. is our major trading partner and, you know, our neighbor to the north and yada, yada, so on and so forth, the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak, the question is always, how does this affect the Bahamas? Well, it's 5 o'clock. You're tuned in to Guardian Talk Radio 96.9 FM. This is The Political Review with your host, K. Quincy Parker. That's me. I'm really glad that you're with us today. I'm going to take a short break, and we'll come back and look at how the U.S. and global financial crisis, the banking crisis that rocked the U.S. just recently, might have an effect on the Bahamas, and we'll go through a little of that in just a short while. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
My business couldn't survive without my credit card machine from Fidelity.
It's fast, convenient, and my clients love it.
My sales increase, and I can track my earnings.
Get your credit card machine from Fidelity today.
Call 356-7764.
At CostRite Wholesale Club, we carry the most tender, succulent, flavorful, and juicy USDA beef and pork you'll ever taste. All at club pricing every time you shop at CostRite's meat department. Cut the chase and meet us at CostRite. We do meat best.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bulla Boy in his phone. What you mean? He take picture of that good-for-nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bulla hair, you say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it will go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for crimes. We know it's you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried it the other day, and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick round the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
After a hurricane or storm, get the Nassau Guardian's Hurricane Guide. The guide will tell you where to purchase building and cleaning supplies, waste disposal, medical care, which auto shop to go to after driving through flooded streets, and much more. The Nassau Guardian's Hurricane Guide will help to make sure everyone knows what to do in the event a hurricane approaches and after it departs. Take advantage of this double insertion opportunity plus 15 radio commercials. Contact us today, 302-2300, 302-2300, or call your account executive. Will you be prepared?
After a brief layoff, Fish Fry Fridays is back in the big carnival month. The Big Band Passage will get you in the mood for the big carnival road march in the streets of Nassau. That's right, it's the pre-carnival edition of Fish Fry Fridays, May 5th at Margaritaville, downtown Nassau. Featuring Passage, DJ AI, and special guest models from the Euphoria Madness Masquerade Band, modeling their costumes that will be on the road for carnival. Fish Fry Fridays is back May 5th. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. $25 general admission. $55 buffet and party. Don't miss Fish Fry Friday. Back with the pre-carnival edition.
It's here. My Solomon Smart Rewards. The ultimate loyalty rewards program. At Solomon's, Fresh Market, or Exuma Markets, start earning smart rewards every time you shop on every item you purchase. Every dollar you spend will earn you one smart rewards point, and points are redeemable in locations. Getting started is quick and easy. Earn smart rewards every time you shop at Solomon's, Fresh Market, or Exuma Markets.
When faced with an illness like cancer, we band together, and we at Cleveland Clinic in Florida have your back. From advanced cancer treatments to extra safety measures at all of our locations, we're with you on this journey. For every infusion and follow-up, for every step of the way, for every care in the world, Cleveland Clinic in Florida. Get the care you need when and where you need it. To learn more or connect with a local representative, visit clevelandclinic.org/Caribbean.
This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Political Review for April 30th, 2023. I am your host, K. Quincy Parker. I am delighted and beyond delighted to be with you this evening. And I wanted to say a happy belated birthday, Dwight Strong. Dwight was adamant when I spoke with him that I share with my audience the birthday greeting that I gave him. So here goes. Dear Dwight, happy birthday to you. You live in a zoo. You look like a monkey and smell like one too. And he's off enjoying his vacation. I hope that he is pleased and satisfied with the tribute that we have paid to him here on Guardian Talk Radio's The Political Review. So, back to the show. We were looking at the banking crisis in the U.S., which has more or less moderated itself by now, and the fallout, which has affected the economic outlook and prospects for the United States, with some really involved players, like the president of the largest bank in the U.S., J.P. Morgan Chase, that would be Jamie Dimon, predicting a recession likely sometime in the next 3-6 to 9 months, with other people more or less agreeing, even the IMF, World Bank, are all sounding the alarm about potential recession in the United States. And whenever that happens, you know, the view is, how does it affect us here in the Bahamas? And we have, you know, the traditional views, but let's look at what the investment analysts are saying about tourism right now. And they're saying that the investment analysts are watching the cloudy financing credit environment's potential impact on the hotel pipeline and each hotel group's net growth rate. And the recent banking crisis may reduce bank lending to businesses in general, cooling business and leisure travel demand. The bank crisis may also make obtaining loans costlier or harder for hotel owners, investors, and developers, leading to a long-term slowdown in hotel refurbishment and construction in the U.S. Many investors wonder if the current U.S. regional bank duress may crimp hotel owners and developers' ability to finance or refinance projects. So we expect to hear analysts ask during earnings calls in the next couple of weeks questions about what percentage of each hotel group's room development pipelines has already committed financing. New York-based Jefferies Group, which is an American multinational independent investment bank and financial services company that provides clients with capital markets and financial advisory services, institutional brokerage, securities research, and asset management, this must debate on whether hotel net unit growth is structurally slower because of worsened financing conditions in the following way. While 10-year U.S. rate, this is Jefferies now, while 10-year U.S. rates have not increased in the last month, if lending conditions were to worsen materially, risks to net growth, to net unit growth, so sorry, Oh, okay. Interesting. So, sorry, that's a text message that I'll read in a moment. But I have to... I'm going to start that again. So New York-based Jefferies Group is saying, while 10-year U.S. rates have not increased in the last month, if lending conditions were to worsen materially, risks to net unit growth would be industry-wide, impacting one, conversions in 2023, and two, delays in development and financing from 2024. Now, to be clear, this is a forecast for U.S.-based tourism development, but my personal question is whether the Bahamas can escape this fallout unscathed. There is a line of possibility here where a problematic outlook for U.S. hotels boost for hotels here in the Bahamas, and I'm sure that that's what our tourism infrastructure is hoping for. But there is another line that could also project problems if the parent companies of these hotels, like the SBE, which is the parent company of the SLS Lux, Rosewood, which is obviously Rosewood, the Grand Hyatt Corporation. These are all American hotel companies, and if they are having issues, then there may be some challenges for developments at Bahama. We'll find out, I suppose. And you know, those are not the only American-owned hotels in the country. So there are two paths that I can see, and we have to be, I think we'll be paying very close attention to which road happens to be the one that we go down. On the question of inflation, which is the second real way I think this crisis may affect us, Nigel Chalk, who's the acting director of the Western Hemisphere Department within the International Monetary Fund, gave a press conference on the sidelines of the spring meetings 2 weeks ago, and he had some good news for our region, saying that we have, pointing out that we have a comfortable output and employment above pre-pandemic levels. In the region, he said, the Western Hemisphere has proven to be very resilient in the face of multiple shocks over the last few years, and growth is repeatedly surprising on the up, growing by 7% in 2021. Latin America and the Caribbean grew by a respectable 4% in 2022, with output and employment, and now comfortably above pre-pandemic levels. Nonetheless, the IMF expects growth to decelerate to 1.6% this year, although the fund expects that most of the region will avoid a recession. The slowdown isn't surprising, given that the region's main trading partners are also slowing. But the favorable terms of trade that were seen in the aftermath of COVID is lessened somewhat, and the global financial conditions are less friendly than they were a year ago. So that's the good news. The bad news is that inflation remains high across the region. We know the high inflation is disproportionately hurting lower income households, particularly as it has been concentrated in large increases in food prices, and because wages have been unable to keep up with these higher prices. After peaking at around 10% in mid-2022 for the average of the region, headline inflation in the largest Latin American economies has now decelerated to around 7%. that's you know, I guess those. Anyway, I'll move on from that. Of relevance to us, central banks in the region would need to keep interest rates high for the rest of 2023 and much of 2024 to combat high inflation until it unambiguously winds down. What's the way forward then from the perspective of the IMF? Well, the fund says there's scope to reduce inefficiencies in public spending. Let me read that again. The IMF says there is scope to reduce inefficiencies in public spending. The fund also believes the population is more likely to embrace a more prudent public finance if government services are seen to be provided efficiently. Oh, welcome the day. And according to the fund, taxes can be redesigned to both raise revenue and make the tax systems more progressive. The wealthy and more fortunate should pay more of their fair share to help maintain social cohesion and also to invest in long-term growth. The fund acknowledges that this is a challenging agenda, but asserts that well-designed public policies can restore macroeconomic stability, can tackle inflation, and can bring down the debt in a socially equitable way. The IMF has also projected that financial stresses on more advanced countries will have little to no effect on this region. Chalk addressed the recent banking stresses in advanced economies. These problems have had little impact on Latin America and the Caribbean. In part, this is because the direct linkages between Latin America and the troubled institutions in the US and Europe are relatively limited. Also, in part, this is a payoff from past investments in the region to strengthen supervision and regulation and hold the region's banks to a high standard. Our final clip today is Chalk addressing some questions from a reporter from St. Kitts that I think, I just thought it was interesting. So I want you to hear his thoughts on tourism-dependent economies and also his thoughts on the region's citizenship by investment programs, something that St. Kitts in particular is heavily invested in. And here, Wally, if you would play that clip, I'd be grateful.
Let me start with the CBI programs, the citizenship by investment programs. So these have been in the Caribbean, particularly for St. Kitts, and we're generally very supportive of those. They've generated an important amount of revenues for the country, and those revenues offer the potential to be deployed in a range of areas, and there's lots of needs, including, as you mentioned, to some extent, social spending, but also the region is very prone to hurricanes. There's a lot of need to make the infrastructure more resilient to adapt to climate change and also to decarbonize the economy because the countries are very exposed to big shifts in global fuel prices. So I think on the whole, the CBI program has been important in these countries. I would point to two things. thinking about how to structure them. First of all, this revenue is very volatile. So I think you have to be very careful about spending that revenue in a lumpy way. So we prefer a system where the CPI revenue is basically saved and some spending is derived from that revenue basically through the stream of income that those savings creates. That's a more stable system rather than having kind of stop-go spending linked to depending on how much CPI revenue you get in a year. And I think it's really important to maintain the integrity and actually to improve the integrity of these schemes, given their reliance on sort of recognition by some of the larger economies. And in that, the ECCU is moving ahead, actually. I think recently they had a press release that they're moving ahead to improve the integrity of these schemes in conjunction with some of the larger economies. In terms of on the general advice on tourism-dependent economies, I think you have seen in our global forecast, we think the U.S. economy is going to slow, but it's still growing pretty strongly. And one of the aspects that's going on in the U.S. economy right now is there's a shift from goods consumption to services consumption. So even though that shift from goods to services is actually good for the Caribbean, it's good for tourism-dependent economies because Americans are traveling more, they're investing more in leisure activities and so forth. And so that's proven, I think we've seen across the region, the Caribbean, that's proven quite a big boost to the economies. We don't see a recession, so we feel that potential flow of tourism is going to be maintained. But I think it would be prudent for the countries in the region to think about what would they do if it were to slow, if the U.S. were to slow down, if interest rates in the U.S. had to go higher in order to bring down inflation, not as a baseline scenario, but more as contingency planning in case the U.S. were to slow down. And the same is true for Europe as well, because they're very reliant on Europe. Thanks.
Thanks.
So, yeah, just basically vigilance, attention, careful plotting and planning, and the region should get through what may be a recession in the U.S. in the next half of the year with little impact. That is my hope. And, let's hope that everything plays out the way the folks at the IMF and the World Bank are predicting. The text message here is a good one. If C. Allen Johnson is still in the Bahamas, and he called in last week, invite him to call in on their consultancy and the economic forecast in light of what you've presented so far. This person is a critical thinker cheerleader. C. Allen and I had a great talk last week about the digital asset space and the DARE Act itself, and in my view, the shortcomings of the Act, which I can really sum up in a sense that the Act itself is outward facing. It is intended to attract investors to the sector from outside the country without much attention being paid to building domestic investment in the digital assets sector. And I would love to hear from C. Allen on the question of the proposed amendments, given that those amendments were dropped very quietly late last week. I anticipate that folks will need some time to look at them, but they are available on the Securities Commission of the Bahamas website. That's scb.gov.bs. That's scb.gov.bs. And I encourage you to click on the DARE Bill 2023 consultation document. It's 83 pages, so you know, you go through it at your own speed, but it's crucial that, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Crypto Isle is going to be doing a survey. So when you see that survey come across your email or your social media channels, click on the link and do it. But read the document first, and see what the government is considering, and see what the regulator has to say about those considerations. So I'm going to end the show there for this week. And at 6 o'clock, the Let's Talk Together in English is up with Lady T. Thank you very much for your time and energy today. Again, happy birthday to Dwight. Wally, thank you for your hard work as usual. We will see you next week. And until then, God bless you. And have a good time. All right, that's it for me. I'm out.